point in our closing remarks that while ever the King of the North and the King of the South are basically preoccupied with each other, then the people of God are not the subject of the attention of either one, and we enjoy freedom during that period to develop a work of preparation or carry forward whatever other work God may have in mind for us at that given point of time. Satan, down to the ages, has used the Babylonian system far more frequently than he has the atheistic system. Atheism is a backstop, something he falls back on when Babylon's power has been so broken that it is not able to serve his purpose. And really, about the only time in history when atheism has ruled the world is back in the days of Egypt. After 1798, of course, Egypt did again come to the fore to a certain extent, but not so predominantly as to enslave the people of God. And never again, of course, will atheism do that. At the present time, the Islamic forces, which are really the King of the South, and the communist forces are thinking in terms of world dominion, but as we shall read toward the end of Daniel chapter 11, they will come to their end, and Babylon will be the world ruler, not the Islamic and the atheistic powers. So, we'll pass fairly quickly over verses 5 down to verse 13. Now, in verse 14, we read these words, "And in those times there shall many stand up against the King of the South. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision that they shall fall." Very appropriately, the Babylonian system is called the robbers of thy people. And this indeed, of course, they truly are. Because whenever God's folk have prospered, the Babylonians have come in to take away that prosperity. They robbed Jerusalem of the gold and silver treasures that were there in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, and this has been their practice all the way down through the history of mankind. Verse 16 introduces the rise of pagan Romanism. "But he that cometh against him shall do according to his will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed." Verses 16 down to verse 29 deal with various historical facts in the development of pagan Rome, including, of course, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, brought to view in verse 22. "With the arms of the flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the Prince of the Covenant." We recognize that the Prince of the Covenant, of course, is Jesus Christ and none other. We go back a little bit to verse 20, and I'm just going to top the high points in these verses, because we're not so concerned about the story of ancient Rome anymore. We're much more concerned about what shall befall thy people in the latter days. Now verse 20, which says, you go back to verse 19, which says, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land. They shall stumble and fall and not be found." A prophecy in regard to the death of Julius Caesar. Verse 20, "Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but in a few days shall he be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." And this, of course, is Tiberius Caesar, the great raiser of taxes. And so we find that down to verse 29 we have a survey of some of the important points in regard to the history of pagan Rome, led by the various Caesars, Tiberius Caesar, Augustus Caesar, Julius Caesar, and so on. We'll now start a more thorough study of the 11th chapter of Daniel in verse 30. And we'll make this quite thorough now down to the end of the chapter and on into chapter 12, because this is the more important part of the prophecy so far as we're concerned. There is profit, of course, in looking at the history of the King of the North, the King of the South, and also in the history of pagan Rome, but our time is limited, and I do want to get to the entire book, so we'll not take time over this less important part of the prophecy. Now verse 30. "For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved in return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand in his parts, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily, and they shall place the abomination and make it desolate." First of all, let's determine who the him is that's referred to in this particular verse. It can be none other, of course, than the power referred to in the previous verses, which, as we have just mentioned, of course, is pagan Rome. Now, pagan Rome did not know defeat or setback until the year 476 AD. In the year 476 AD, we find that the great reversals began. And they began at the hands of the barbarian kings, which came down with all their might and power from the north and from the east of Europe. The Huns, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Burgundians, the Franks, the Vandals, and so on. And very obviously, the ships of Chittim are a reference to these great powers that came pouring down with fresh strength and vigor, a very tough, a very resilient, a very warlike, a very fierce race of people. And they flooded into the Roman Empire, and as they came against the Romans found themselves forced to return. It says, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. We realize, of course, that the Holy Covenant can refer only to the covenant made between God and his people, otherwise called the Everlasting Covenant or the New Covenant. The point has been made quite strongly yesterday that the rise of the papal system can only take place subsequent to apostasy amongst God's people. Let's now just review a little bit of what we have learned in regard to the history of the early Christian church, as we looked at it last year in particular, of course, in the story of Paul under the influence of the church leaders in Jerusalem. So we'll go right back to Paul's day, which was probably something about 40 years or thereabouts AD. I think the date in my Bible, let's turn to Acts, the 21st chapter, just to get a date line there. And in Acts 21, we find about AD 59, roughly about 60 years after the birth of Jesus Christ, something like 20 to 30 years after the death of Jesus Christ. We find it in the early Christian church. Let's first of all put down the fact that in those days we have the mighty power of Rome, pagan Rome, which ruled the world. And so far as pagan Rome was concerned, we recognize that it was a fully developed Babylon. And it had no need of an apostate Christianity. It was completely self-sufficient militarily, and it dominated and ruled the entire world and knew no rivals and no contenders. Now over here, side by side and within that Roman Empire, there was the Christian church. And within that Christian church, there were two forces at work. Now, one force led by the leaders of the church in Jerusalem, such as James, the brother of Jesus Christ, and the various other leading brethren, were determined to make man, to place man in God's place as the plan maker and leader of the church. Remember the story we learned? We said that story last year in a chapter called Paul, a Prisoner, in the book Acts the Apostle. But then on the other hand, in the church, there was the other force led by the Apostle Paul, and he kept reiterating that Jesus Christ is the head of every man in the church. Now the Holy Covenant that God calls upon us to make with him includes our recognizing and keeping Jesus Christ as the one true head of the church. Now if we start to place man as leader in the church in the place of Christ, then are we not forsaking the Holy Covenant? Right? That is the forsaking of the Holy Covenant. Now, as we saw last year, within the church, these two powers contended for supremacy. Unfortunately, Paul made the mistake, and he yielded to the influence of these men, with the result that very, very soon, his life was sacrificed, and the church was left under the leadership and in the power of these men who sought to place man in the place of God. An inevitable consequence, of course, was that they came nearer and nearer to the Roman situation influence, and a time came when pagan Rome, having lost the power militarily to rule the world, joined forces with this apostasy so that a returning Rome had intelligence with them that forsook the holy covenant. Now, what was the only possible outcome of this kind of mixture, this coalition of these two forces which were at heart the same? Here we have paganism, here we have apostate Christianity, and when these two things blended into one new power, we have an awesome monster called the papacy. And that found its roots in both the Christian church and the pagan Roman system. And of all the Babylonian manifestations in history, that has been the worst, hasn't it? I mean, read the life story of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He was a kind man compared to those popes and rulers who dominated Europe during the Dark Ages. And the era of Babylonian supremacy was enlightened age compared to the darkness of the Dark Ages. And so therefore we have the very, very worst system of all that this history has ever seen in the form of the papacy. However, that will not begin to compare with the awfulness of the coming manifestation of Babylon, which will appropriately be called Babylon the Great. That will be by far the worst of all. Now, if today, within this movement, we in any way subscribe to the principles of those leaders back there, then where will we, what are we actually helping to build? The worst manifestation of Babylonian power that history will ever witness. Do you want that role? We don't, do we? We don't want to be part of that kind of development. Now, of course, such organizations as the Seventh-day Adventist Church, in which we have a system in which man is the plan maker in the place of God, the Protestant churches were the same thing as being carried forward, the Roman Catholic Church were the same thing as also to be found, and all the business organizations of the world, all the political organizations of the world, where man is the head in the place of Christ, every one of them today is individually and very soon collectively building up the worst manifestation of Babylon the history will ever have seen. And I'm so glad that God has given us the light which has separated us from those organizations and systems. So we can be totally clear of that kind of work, and instead we can be God's instruments to build up the other system where Jesus Christ alone is the head of his church. And so as the Roman legions came back from their outposts of empire to fall back on the home base of Rome, we find that Satan needed now a new manifestation through which he could work. Pagan Rome was decaying and dying away. It was no longer of any use to him. It was falling under the power of those Arians, who of course were atheists in effect. They didn't really believe in God. They had a belief in God, but it wasn't a true belief in God in any real shape and form. Of course, bear in mind that Egypt is called an atheistic power. It was not a godless power. They simply rejected the God of heaven, the real God. Egypt was a nation with multiplied gods, sun gods and rain gods and moon gods and harvest gods and all kinds of gods. Now, Satan, of course, anticipated this coming event. Satan knew perfectly well. Satan knows, he understands the truth. He knows that any force which he builds up has its day. And so long before that power comes to nothing, he's busily preparing the replacement. And so it was, he worked in the Christian church to build up the replacement and to join that power with the decaying power of pagan Rome to form the next manifestation of power, which was the papacy. Now, we come to verse 31, which says, "And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate." Very naturally, of course, when the Arian hordes came down from the north, they had the ambition to fill the world with their religion and with their culture and with their way of life. That's always the way of it. In other words, I read, for instance, in I think Newsweek or Time magazine, that Russia in Afghanistan has now brought in Russian as the second language in the schools. So every child in Afghanistan now must learn Afghanistan. In school, you also must learn Russian. Now, before the Russian invasion, was that the case? Obviously not. And so the Russian culture is now being imposed upon this subdued nation. Well, it's partly subdued, of course. There are lots of guerrillas and terrorists and so forth very busy in that country still. Now, naturally, of course, when the Arians came down to take possession of Europe, as they did, It was their ambition to fill Europe not with the Roman Catholic, but with the Arian religion. And they were being very successful about this, to the place where it appeared as if Roman Catholicism was going to be wiped out and Arianism take its place. Now, the most powerful of the Arian kings was Clovis, the king of the Franks. He had the greatest army, and he occupied a territory which was relatively close, of course, to Italy and to the seat of Roman Catholic power. Now, the story goes that Clovis was preparing to establish the Arian religion throughout Europe when, as a result of a long-standing exertion of influence on the part of his Christian wife, so-called Christian wife, and as a result of a very significant vision he had one night, he became converted to Christianity. He became a Roman Catholic. And the next day, he told his soldiers they were all Roman Catholics too, and as Clovis said so, well, they were. You know, it'd be nice if we convert people that easy, wouldn't it? I suppose they reckoned if they didn't become Clovis's Catholic friends, they'd all become dead soldiers, so they thought it was the easier course to take. So suddenly, almost overnight, the Roman Catholic power found itself in a new situation. The army which it had most dreaded, the one which it had expected would come and fight against the Catholic power, now became the opposite, namely its ally. Arms stood upon the part of the Catholic Church. So instead of being faced with extinction, she now was supported and had the guarantee of continuance. And so the Catholic religion was established. And the establishment of the Catholic religion meant, as it only could, the taking away of the daily and the polluting of the sanctuary of strength. Now, in what ways does the Roman Catholic system pollute the sanctuary of strength, and in what ways does the Roman Catholic system take away the daily? You notice, of course, I persistently drop the word sacrifice. We never say the word sacrifice. We simply say the word daily, and here's the reason why. We have, of course, in the Word of God, two sanctuaries. First of all, we have the Old Testament sanctuary, and it was down here upon the earth. And in connection with the Old Testament sanctuary, there was a daily sacrifice. But there's a New Testament sanctuary, which of course is not down here upon this earth. It's up in heaven. And in connection with that sanctuary, there is not a daily sacrifice. Because how many times did Jesus Christ die as a sacrifice for sin? Once for all time. And so we must never use the word daily sacrifice in respect of the New Testament sanctuary. Now, we're dealing with New Testament times when we come down here to verse 31 in Daniel chapter 11. Is this New Testament times? Where are we? As a matter of fact, we're in that exact year of 508, I beg your pardon, A.D. Is that New Testament times? All right, then. So the only daily which we can talk about here, the only sanctuary which we can talk about here is the New Testament or heavenly sanctuary, in connection with which there is a daily, but not a daily sacrifice. What do we mean then, or what is meant by the expression daily? Well, we go back to the daily sacrifice, and the daily has to be the anti-type of the daily sacrifice. Doesn't it? Or doesn't it? Right. Very good. Now, the daily sacrifice consisted, first of all, of the burnt offering. You read about this in Leviticus, the first chapter. It then dealt with the meal offering, and then with the peace offering. There was the burnt offering, the meal offering, and the peace offering. Now, what did these three things signify? They signified, first of all, the burnt offering signified, first of all, because of the sacrifice of life, the dedication on the part of the people attending that sacrifice of their lives to God to be used in His service, either in life or death, as would best serve the cause of God. Now, there is at the present time a little theory which is being promoted by one or two people in various parts of the world field. When you get your Californian tapes, I still have some stocks left here if you want them. There is quite a thorough appraisal of this theory in that particular camping. I'll just make some of the main points again, just as an aside. I really want to deal with the daily, but I will make some of these points in passing through that. And this theory is that it runs along these lines: sin causes sickness, and sickness causes death. Therefore, get rid of all sin, You won't die. You can, if you have the faith to believe it, you can live from now until when Jesus comes, even if that should be 100 years or 200 years away. And the argument that is propounded is this, that God does not deal in death, that only life will glorify God. Now, that's the main point, that only by our living can we glorify God. That is not true. Let's now look at the experience of John the Baptist. As you remember, John the Baptist became concerned about Christ's mission. And he sent some of his disciples to talk with Christ to find out whether, after all, Christ was really the Messiah, or had they made a mistake in identifying him as such. Now, these men came back to John and gave him a report of what Christ had done and said. And as John the Baptist came to understand more clearly the nature of Christ's mission, he made a very interesting dedication, which I shall now read to you in Desire of Ages, page 218. The Saviour's words, "Blessed is he, whosoever shall find none occasion of stumbling in me," were a gentle reproof to John. It was not lost upon him. Now listen, understanding more clearly now the nature of Christ's mission, he yielded himself to God for life or for death, as should best serve the interests of the cause of God. Now, are there occasions when the death of one of God's people will serve his cause better than that person's living? Is God glorified thereby? Absolutely. And in the morning sacrifice of the burnt offering, each individual dedicated himself to God for that day for life or for death, as would best serve the cause of God. So that if that day God could be glorified in the death of one of his saints, that person would gladly yield up his life for that purpose. Let's read a little further in this respect in regard to John the Baptist, because Sister White simply tells us that John did no more and no less than to participate in the sufferings of Jesus Christ. There's quite a bit I could read here on page 224 in regard to the life story of John. It tells us that whereas God could very easily have saved the life of John, that John was permitted to pass under Satan's power. We read it in these words, "Jesus did not interpose to deliver his servants. He knew that John would bear the test. Gladly would the Saviour have come to John to brighten the dungeon gloom with his own presence, but he was not to place himself in the hands of enemies and imperil his own mission. Gladly would he have delivered his faithful servants, but for the sake of thousands who in after years must pass from prison to death, John was to drink the cup of martyrdom. As the followers of Jesus should languish in lonely cells or perish by the sword, the rack, or the faggot, apparently forsaken by God and man, what a stay to their hearts would be the thought that John the Baptist, to whose faithfulness Christ himself had borne witness, had passed through a similar experience. Satan was permitted to cut short the earthly life of God's messenger, that life which is hid with Christ in God, the destroyer could not reach. He exulted that he had brought sorrow upon Christ, but he failed of conquering John. Death itself only placed him forever beyond the power of temptation. In this warfare, Satan was revealing his own character. Before the witnessing universe, he made manifest his enmity toward God and man. Though no miraculous deliverance was granted John, he was not forsaken. He had always the companionship of heavenly angels, who opened to him the prophecies concerning Christ and the precious promises of Scripture. These were his stay, as they were to be the stay of God's people throughout the coming ages. To John the Baptist, as to those that came after him, was given the assurance, "Lo, I am with you all the days, even unto the end." God never leads his children otherwise than they would choose to be led if they could see the end from the beginning and discern the glory of the purpose which they are fulfilling as co-workers with him. Not Enoch, who was translated to heaven, not Elijah, who ascended in a chariot of fire, was greater or more honored than John the Baptist, who perished alone in the dungeon. Unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. Philippians 1 verse 29. Now suffering for his sake, of course, may take us as far as death. And of all the gifts that heaven can bestow upon men, fellowship with Christ in his sufferings is the most weighty trust and the highest honor. And for that reason, of course, the martyrs in heaven will have a very special honor. Around their garments will be a red border, to designate them as having entered into the fellowship of Christ in a deeper way than the average person has done. So let's make no mistake that while it may seem very logical to say that God does not find honour in the death of his saints, that may sound logical, it's not true. Because God is honoured by the death of his saints, as he was by the death of John the Baptist, the very, very wonderful purpose was achieved thereby, much more so than if John the Baptist had remained alive. So when John the Baptist made a dedication to God to live or to die as would best serve the cause of God, he was simply carrying out the daily dedication involved in the offering of the burnt offering, the first offering of every day in the encampment of Israel. Now the offering of the meal offering was a handful of fine flour. It was not a blood sacrifice, no life was taken, and the worshippers, through that offering, thereby dedicated to God all that they possessed. Their money, their houses, their lands, their talents, their abilities, their jobs, everything was laid upon the altar of sacrifice in the daily consecration of the meal offering. And finally, the peace offering signified, of course, the fact that through these dedications of man to God's service, of man to God's planning, perfect peace was established between the great source on the one hand and the connector and the receiver down here upon this earth in the person of mankind. Beyond this, of course, was a daily sin offering. Whenever a person committed sin, he then came to the sanctuary with his sacrifice, and upon confession of the sin and the slaying of the victim, the sin was literally transferred from him into the sanctuary, and the life of Christ was put back into him in the place of where the sin had been. Now, when Jesus Christ went to heaven, of course, after his resurrection, then that same daily ministry is carried forward. And when you bow down at the beginning of every day, and as you offer your life to God as you should do, for a life of service, or for service and death according to God's plan. Don't forget that last point. As God himself shall plan it, and we follow that by a dedication of all we've got to God to be used as God shall plan it shall be used for that day. And then, having done those, we recognize that peace has been made between us and God. And then later, if we forsake the Holy Covenant at some small point, and we come and confess that sin before Jesus Christ himself and give that sin to him and receive his life in its place, then we are rejoicing in the daily, day by day. That's the actual practice of carrying out the daily in our experience as each day comes to us. How did the Roman Catholic Church rob the people of the daily? By her teaching. First of all, the people did not consecrate themselves to God every day, they consecrated themselves to the church every day. Isn't that right? And their lives were dedicated to the church for life or to death as would best serve the interests of the church and as the church in the place of God should dictate. And secondly, they dedicated all their money and their possessions, even their families, all that they had, not to God but the church every day. And so completely did the church take the place of God in their lives, that even when they needed confession of sin or forgiveness of sin, they didn't go to God to obtain confession of sin, they went to whom? They went to the church. The church was everything. The church was the complete replacement of Jesus Christ. And thus, in every possible sense of the word, the Roman Catholic Church took away the daily from the people of God and gave them something else which was of the church instead of being entirely and completely of God. So God was replaced. He had no part nor position anymore in the lives of those sad people. Now, in what way does the Roman Catholic Church pollute the sanctuary of strength? First of all, what is the sanctuary of strength? Christ's sanctuary. It's the only strong sanctuary, the only sanctuary in which strength comes to people upon this earth, because most certainly, of course, the Roman Catholic Churches cannot provide strength. They are instead a desolating power. The Catholic Church does this by teaching the people that every Roman Catholic Church is the anti-type of the Old Testament sanctuary, with the result that they completely obliterated the truth that the sanctuary of God is to be found up in heaven above. Now, so powerful was this influence that it was like the teaching among the Jews before Christ came the first time, that Christ was coming as a powerful general to wipe out the Romans and establish the Jews as the leading nation upon the face of the earth. And so deeply ingrained was that teaching in the minds of the apostles even, that when Christ taught them otherwise, they still could not believe and see the real truth of the matter. And so when the reformers were delivered from Roman Catholic power, back in the days of Wycliffe, Huss and Jerome, Luther, and so on, they still did not see, even though they read the book of Hebrews, that the Christian sanctuary is not down upon this earth, it's up in heaven above. And even William Miller, who lived 300 years after the Reformers escaped from Roman Catholic tyranny and from Roman Catholic teaching, still believed that this earth was the sanctuary. Now then, if this earth is the sanctuary, what kind of a sanctuary is it? Clean or polluted? It's polluted. And it wasn't until after 1844, after October 22, 1844, the people of God finally came to see that the sanctuary is indeed up in heaven above. Now this bespeaks an enormous power, of course, on the part of the church, because when they had the power to persuade the entire world that the sanctuary of God is not up in heaven above, but down here upon this earth, and to so obliterate that teaching from history that the entire world lost it for hundreds of years, it bespeaks the enormous power exercised by the Roman Catholic Church at that point of time. Now, we're plainly told in verse 31 that they would place the abomination that maketh desolate. And we had some remarks on this the other day. I'd like to just kind of repeat them because I feel they're so important. And I find every time I say them again, it gives me a clearer picture of what these words mean. In the place of the daily, which could only be the daily while Christ occupies his rightful place, they would put the abomination and makes desolate. Okay, then let's look now at the substitution. So we've got the substitution very, very clearly and plainly in mind. First of all, we write over on this side the daily. We've already described this, we shan't repeat the description again, but the point I want to make is this, that for the daily, to be the daily, Jesus Christ must be the head of every man in the church. Because the blessings of the daily and the ministration of the daily can come only from God through Jesus Christ to us. So if Christ does not have his rightful place, then can we have the blessings of the daily? That's impossible. It's quite impossible. Now, as we've seen before, the Roman Catholic Church replaced the daily with a system, with the Roman Catholic daily. We'll put here the counterfeit daily on this side, which is the abomination makes desolate. And in this, not Jesus Christ, but the church is the head of every man. And what is the church? It's men, right? It's popes and prelates, bishops and archbishops, and so forth, and they became the head of every man in the church. And of course, there are many heads, with the result, of course, we have a monster in the place of the other. Now, the argument that causes people to want to drift toward this system over here is this. They say, well, now look, I don't see too much light in the Sabbath rest message because it degrades me from being a person with the power to plan my own life to a person who must be subject to Christ in everything. Now, God gave me the power to organize. God gave me the power to direct. God gave me the power to build and so forth. If I don't use those God-given powers, then I'm going to atrophy. I'm going to shrink up and shrivel until there's nothing left of me. I'm going to become desolated. A barren, empty waste. A place where there's no growth and no life whatsoever. Now that's very logical, isn't it? That sounds very logical. And it's the kind of logic that many people succumb to. But all we have to do is to look at the outworking of these two different systems. Now wherever we find in human history a church, an organization, a system, be it Catholic, Protestant, atheistic, communistic, Islamic, heathen, no matter where you find it, wherever you find this thing, you find something which desolates mankind. That desolation can be described in ignorance, the darkness of people not even knowing some very simple scientific and and religious and other facts. It results in moral degradation. It results in disease. It results in death. It results in wars, in quarrelings, in bitterness and so forth. In short, it results in desolation. And because it results in all that, to God it is an abomination. The abomination that, to use the word scripture, that makes desolate. This thing, this thing where the church is the head over every man, where men are the head over men, is the abomination that makes desolate. No matter where you may go in history, wherever that abomination reigns, you'll find desolation is the result. Everywhere you go. But now on the other hand, let's take this other system. And wherever this other system where Jesus Christ is the one and only head of the church, where the daily is fully established, so God is the plan maker and the burden bearer, and we make our consecration to God every day to give our lives and our means to be used as He will plan, then is this a desolator or is this an elevator? Right, it's an elevator. Here we find freedom from sin, freedom from war, freedom from sickness, freedom from disunity. Here we find peace and prosperity. Here we find men growing up to be astonishing individuals, as the Bible says in Zechariah 3, men to be wondered at. And I suppose that one of the most outstanding examples in this case, of course, is Daniel together with his three friends. So outstanding, so amazing were the capacities of this particular man that the great rulers and kings of his day, such as Darius, the king of the Medes, regarded Daniel as the most valuable statesman upon the face of the earth. And when the jealous statesman decided to destroy him, the king was desperate in his efforts to save that man because he knew the value of this man. But that man was the product of this system, wasn't he? The system where Jesus Christ was the head of every man in the church. And those who admired him were the product of this system, and they were the lesser, not the greater, of the two. And that's why it says back in Deuteronomy that when the people of God truly relate themselves to Him, they will be the head and not the tail. Right? The first and not the last. And yet, sad to say, of course, God's folk down through the ages have not been, for the most part, the head. They've been the tail. They've not been the first. They have been the last. And why have they been? Because they've never learned to make Jesus Christ the one and only head of their lives. Now, Satan, of course, is intent on taking away the daily and setting up the abomination that makes desolate. But how thankful we are that from 1844 on, as we learnt last night from Daniel 8 and verse 14, that Satan's power to take away the daily, tread down the sanctuary, and to rob the people of God of their freedom was forever broken by 1844. In fact, it was broken by 1798. But after the breaking of Roman Catholic power in 1798, it did take a few years before the sanctuary could be restored to its rightful state. At that point on, the freedom of God's people is forever assured, and the daily becomes the glorious blessing that we have day by day as we march on toward that final victory. Now, very obviously, of course, those of us who learn to avail ourselves of the full blessings of the daily in the consecration of our lives, possessions, and so forth to Christ, service every day, to Christ planning every day, such people are in the school of preparation, the only effective preparation which can make us ready to engage in the last battle where there'll be no human planning of any kind whatsoever. And as we move on in our subsequent studies to the rest of Daniel chapter 11 and 12, I do hope that we'll catch the vision of the secret by which the work of God in the last days shall be finished. It can only be finished by a people who know Jesus Christ as their head and who admit no man to be head in the place of Jesus Christ. Time to stop, so we'll pause at this point and look forward to our next study, which of course will be at 6:30 this evening, as Friday afternoon of course is a free afternoon for Sabbath preparation.